tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny in All That Air, the Philip Larkin Society podcast. My name is Lynn Lockwood. As PLS members will know, our AGM that normally takes place in early June always features a distinguished guest lecturer, and the Society has had many wonderful speakers over the years. A good number of these were recorded and turned into cassettes and CDs for members to buy. So we have a lovely back catalogue, which we'd like to send out to a new audience. Novelist and Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, Anne Fine, OBE, was our guest in 2004 with her talk entitled Philip Larkin, A Personal View. Anne talks about her childhood spent in a home with enormous trees in the back garden and how Larkin's poetry has come to mean so much to her. But she also reflects on modern publishing and the continuing debate around Larkin's image following the publication of his letters in 1992 and Andrew Motion's biography in 1993. Although Anne is talking to us from nearly 20 years ago, her ideas and thoughts seem as if they could have been written this year.
The first thing I want to say today is how consummately ill-qualified I feel to be giving this talk to you all today. I never met Philip Larkin. I never studied Philip Larkin. Indeed, I never did English beyond O-level. And like Bellow's Augie March, I would have to admit that when it comes to writing, I actually go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle. So I'm pretty sure that it is a safe bet that absolutely everybody in this room knows more about Philip Larkin than I ever have or ever will. I was hoping that some of the people who were serving might still be around to give me confidence that I did at least know more than some people. That has not happened, tragically. Anyway, the one thing I do bring with me today is a quite unfeigned and unqualified admiration of Philip Larkin. I have admired his way of going about his professional life. I think he is the finest poet of his time by far, and his work has all the qualities I most revere and would most like to emulate. And he is the only poet to whom I have ever written a fan letter. It may not be much to base a talk on, but I shall try. And I must apologise in advance for the somewhat haphazard nature of what is to come. Recently, I was checking something in Hazel Rowley's biography of Christina Stead, and I came across the biographer saying of her subject that she had the grab-bag mind of an imaginative writer rather than that of an intellectual. And Patrick White claimed much the same about his own mind in his autobiography. He said, "I knew I hadn't got a scholar's mind. Such as I had was more like the calico bag hanging from the sewing room doorknob, stuffed with snippets of material of contrasting textures and clashing colours, which might at some future date be put to some practical, aesthetic or even poetic use." Now, this talk is going to have a very strong air of odd bits stuffed in a bag about it, and I do hope for your patience. The first book of poetry that I ever bought was High Windows. From the rather dried-up little price sticker on the back, I saw when I was looking at it that it only cost £1.12, but I can be pretty sure that I must have thought quite a lot of it to have paid even that, because I came from a home with no money to spare at all, and apart from asking for books for birthdays and Christmas and buying a few of my favourites second-hand in local jumble sales, I had always been more used to using the library. I'd like to claim that I had a really lofty reason for the fact that this was the first book of poems for which I ever put down hard money. But I rather suspect that the reason was more to do with the fact that one of my school friends had shown it to me, a book off her parents' shelves that offered words like bloody, pissing yourself, fucking, diaphragm, snuffing it, old farts, a crowd of craps, in a pig's ass, and bitches. I suspect that only just out of a household in which I'd grown up where my own use of almost any one of those words would have resulted in my father's arm coming out of nowhere and sending me flying across the room, or my mother giving me such a shredding that I wouldn't have been able to face myself for days, that it was the sheer exhilarating openness of the language, the courage, and the lack of mealy-mouthedness of it that made me prepared to lash out hard cash once I met the book again in a bookshop. And then I was ensnared for life. Surprisingly, given the absence of forbidden language in the poem, it was the trees that did it. And for those of you who have, sort of the same sort of amnesia I get with things, I'm just going to read it through again at this point, just in case. The trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. The recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. Is it that they are born again and we grow old? No, they die too. Their yearly trick of looking new is written down in rings of grain. Yet still the unresting castles thresh in full-grown thickness every May. Last year is dead, they seem to say. Begin afresh, afresh, afresh. Now, perhaps I should explain that my entire childhood had revolved round two particular trees, both vast horse chestnuts with preservation orders on them, standing side by side in the walled garden of the house where I grew up. My father had bought the house when I was nine. Up until then, we'd been in a council house down in Fareham, and then he was an electronic engineer, and he moved up to work at Bletchley Park in the engineering side of it, and he had five of us. He had my elder sister, myself, and then in a last desperate attempt to get at least one son, he had three more triplet girls. And because it's quite hard to get someone else to look after five small children for much longer than a weekend, my parents had looked at 40 houses in the one weekend they had free for house hunting, and they had chosen the one called The Hermitage, where I grew up, with its vast trees. My mother always claimed that they chose the house because on one of the coldest, snowiest weekends of the year, the sun had flooded in through the French doors as the two of them were looking round it. Not all that thoroughly, I might say, since it was not until the snow melted 2 weeks later, after they'd moved in, that they realised that the house was actually thatched. and rather poorly thatched at that. My father said later that they bought it because it was such a mess that the owner was prepared to sell it dead cheap and even offer a private mortgage, and that they hadn't been able to afford a survey anyway, which was perhaps just as well, given the state of it. I'm actually one of the few people in life who has actually gone to sleep against the noise of Death Watch beetles. So there we grew up, and the natural year actually revolved around those giant trees. My mother, rather like my Mrs. Collett in the novel In Cold Domain, proved to have only three favourite gardening tools: the axe, the flamethrower, and the poison spray. And gradually, what had been a very rich and interesting garden began to resemble some lost corner of the Russian steppes. The trees, however, being legally protected, she couldn't get at. Instead, she never missed an opportunity to take the negative view. As the tree developed its first pale green blush, she would start up. "You realise that I'm going to have to sweep up every single one of those little buggers?" I mean, she was allowed to swear. It was one of those don't do as I do as I say households. When the candles were in their full glory, the tune changed to a heavily martyred, "Well, we all know what this is going to mean." And as the conkers glowed above us, it was dire grousings of the sort. 70 great black bags of them last year, and it looks as if this year there'll be even more. As early as June, she would be claiming to be already sweeping up dead leaves. This in Northamptonshire, for God's sake. And as late as March, when every last leaf had been burned months before in one of her perpetual bonfires, she would still be claiming to be cleaning up after those trees. Now, I suspect that I was not the only one in the family who longed to tell her to knock it off, just give the moaning a rest, but I didn't dare. I can't have been the only one in the family to think that the trees were astonishing, absolutely breathtaking. They weren't just huge, they dwarfed us. They dwarfed the house. And the sheer never-ending magic of the way they changed from month to month never failed to lift my spirits. I still dream about that garden and those trees. And up till the moment I bought that paperback copy of High Windows, few of the poems I cared about were about the natural world. I suspect, like a lot of people, I had been put off in school by Wordsworth's Daffodils. I liked On Wenlock Edge, of course, and Tell Me Not Here, It Needs Not Saying, and Loveliest of Trees, The Cherry Now. But show me the moody teenager who can resist the poignancy of A.E. Housman, and I will show you a clod with a heart of stone. But if you had told me that a poem about a tree by anyone else would have captured my heart, I would have laughed at you. But the point is, of course, that Larkin writes about a tree and gets your whole life in there somewhere. The trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. Now, didn't I know that state of affairs? Children of mothers like mine spend their whole lives not quite daring to say things that are sitting as ready formed as leaves, ready to burst out. These things bud in your brain and they're held while you hold your own breath, the tension absolutely palpable. Who else but Larkin would have picked the simplest as well as the strongest image? Unresting castles. The very image that would speak to someone who had played beneath huge trees in wind and rain and shine, and then on top of that, tap into that relentless renewal of optimism that starts with the growing child. New term, new exercise book, new school, new teacher, and never leaves us. Begin afresh. Afresh. Now, it may sound odd to take a fine, fine poet and then admire him almost as much for other things, but I confess I do. I admire, for example, his capacity to let things take the time they took, never to kid himself that things were done when they weren't, and never to write for writing's sake or for other people's deadlines. Any writer tampers, I think, with his own natural speed at his great peril. And most of the crappy work we see around us has been signed for, with payment and finishing dates agreed, before it's a quarter written. As often as not, the discerning reader can even see the join, the actual page the author reached when the contract was signed. Some of the brightest and most intriguing bits of writing take a nosedive at this point into that ghastly word-processed 1,000 words a day of unsprung, surprise-free mush that is so often the result of a contract fulfilled. Raymond Carver describes the scenario well in a passage from his essay On Writing. He says, I have friends who've told me they had to hurry a book because they needed the money. Their editor or their wife was leaning on them or leaving them. Something, some apology for the writing not being very good. It would have been better if I'd taken the time. I was dumbfounded when I heard a novelist friend say this. If the writing can't be made as good as it is within us to make it, then why do it? In the end, the satisfaction of having done our best and the proof of that labour is the one thing we can take into the grave. I wanted to say to my friend, for heaven's sake, go do something else. There have to be easier and maybe more honest ways to try to earn a living. And of course, yes, there are. Librarianship for one. And I take off my hat to a man who had enough respect for his own work to let it come when it wanted, or not at all. If only every writer could recognise, as he did, when they no longer have what Oscar Wilde called the architecture of thought necessary to carry on. All through the good years, Larkin let the work take its time to be finished, and not in the sense of simply sitting around waiting for some muse to stroll through the door, as he himself once pointed out, moods had to be treated like a technical difficulty, like noisy neighbours or a clergyman's doubts. One had to press on in spite of them. But carrying on in spite of difficulties is not at all the same as settling for the second rate or claiming that something is finished when it isn't. Charles Dickens reminded us that good writing takes patience, attention, seclusion, consideration, and courage to reject what comes uppermost and to try for something better below it. And what was better in Larkin's book was never what was new for new's sake, never what was simply in vogue or pretentious. Sometime during the 1980s, the present tense crept back into fiction and, like a mould, stained almost everything. I mean, I say crept back because, as I recall, this was the way that most of us had learned to read. Here is Peter. Here is Jane. Jane runs to the shop. Jane buys a lolly. Way back in primary one, one or two of the people in the class, the sort whom Victoria Wood once reminded us used to be allowed to sit at the back and do raffia. One or two of these people were even more basic. They even fell back on the second person singular when they were struggling through their Monday morning diaries. I don't know what to write, these people used to wail as the lesson began. Just write down what you do on Saturday or on Sunday, the teacher would suggest impatiently. And out it would come, word by painful word, poorly and laboriously written in heavily licked pencil stub. You go down the shops, you get a lolly and a bar of chocolate, you eat it on the way home. So by the time that we reached primary two, it was also the way we had begun to be told off for writing. I can't remember how our teachers exactly formulated the encouraging primary one equivalent of, oh, for God's sake, grow up. But I do know that till Jay McInerney came along to astonish us with Bright Lights, Big City, none of us had ever thought of writing in the present tense or the second person singular again. And certainly, after the freshness of the first handful of books written in this fashion, none of us would have mistaken continuing hampering ourselves as writers and, dare I say it, irritating and shortchanging the reader in this fashion for staying at the cutting edge. Larkin was cutting edge, but cutting edge in the true sense of the word, that he could make you gasp at the sheer realness and honesty of what he was showing you. He knew how to catch your attention. Look how he captured mine. But as Angus Wilson once said of good novelists, the final effect was not immediate. It was to encourage reflection, to surprise obliquely, to throw light upon the deep places of life, not the surfaces. And he could do all this so neatly. His poems weren't shapeless and incontinent, the sort of stuff that, if it were printed as prose, no one would even think it had been written as poetry. And he could do it in a very few lines. Henry James said, really, universally, relations stop nowhere, and the exquisite problem of the artist is eternally but to draw, by a geometry of his own, the circle in which they shall happily appear to do so. Only the truly inattentive can ever have turned over the page, wondering if there's any more of one of Larkin's poems or if it's finished. Yeah. And along with all this, the man was fearless. His poems about death are about the bravest in the language. He never failed to have the courage to expose his interior life and show himself to others in order to show others to themselves. And he exhibited great courage, too, in the face of institutionalised tosh. It's actually all very well for those of us who are only on a par with or not much better than the herd to say outspokenly that they think something's daft. It's a whole different matter when someone so incontrovertibly outstanding opens his mouth. And though the tide is turning on unreadability tricked out as extra special cleverness, there was a time when huge numbers of us were simply mystified by this great cloud when it appeared, and then began to fear that it would never lift. Not just tosh about novels by those people who, in Clive James's delicious description must have somehow dodged remedial English on the way to their honours degrees. But novels themselves that were tosh. I can't be the only born reader whose mouth dropped open the first time I heard someone talking up a book to the skies, and then when the person they were talking to protested, saying something along the lines that it had been written in a way that made even the plot incomprehensible, heard the reply, "Oh, well, you do have to read it twice." Now, call me a madwoman if you will, but to me, any novel that you have to read twice simply to get has something wrong with it. And I have clung to this opinion. I doubt, actually, if this opinion and I will ever be parted. I will admit my prejudices here. I have the lowest tolerance for doing things differently just for difference's own sake. Already you know enough about my primary school to have guessed that here was an institution of learning which would have prided itself on recognising the distinction between a mistake and a sign of free expression. And I am confident that the place would also have stood four square against the tide of postmodernism, alias the curse of Pomo. As for magical realism, talking monkeys suddenly turning up in purportedly otherwise serious and grown-up novels, people chatting to one another as they fall out of aeroplanes, "See me," they would have written at the bottom, then ticked you off for wasting their marking time by simply being silly. So imagine the comfort of coming across required writing, of finding another person on the planet who thought so much of the exact right word with all the cultural freight that each word brings to those who learned their language through the nursery rhymes and feel the subtleties through the skin, that he could honestly and fearlessly say even things like, "I don't see how one can ever know a foreign language well enough to make reading poems in it worthwhile." What did he make me, not at the time an unskilled linguist, feel? He made me feel, I am not mad. The best living poet I've ever read shares some of the suspicions I have. And later, I came to read his views on what had happened to English poetry, that it had gone off on a loop line that took it away from the general reader. Right from the start, I'd set off in all good faith to read everything that came my way. But by my 30s, I couldn't have agreed more. Larkin claimed that good poems are self-sufficient and don't need professional elucidators. Again, he could have been speaking for thousands of us. He said, "To me, the only qualifications required for reading poetry are the understanding of the language it is written in and a feeling heart. Poetry demanding more than this does not deserve close academic instructions and deserves to be slapped down. Good on you, Philip." Now, one might have tremendous respect for Philip Larkin's own poetry, yet wonder why another writer would so value the fact that he voiced his opinions so clearly and made clear his reservations and even quite often his contempt for certain sorts of art and music and writing. And I think it's because another writer gradually becomes particularly, indeed often painfully, aware of the fact that whether a piece of writing is good or not comes to consist in what a heap of other people say about it over time. I mean, that is, in a sense, our definition of a classic. There is no independent standard of excellence out there in the heavens. It grows out of a shared cultural practice among artists and those writing about them. As often as not, in the case of writers and poets, the very same people themselves, in judging the works. So if the judgment's a way off beam, it is potentially corrupting to those very standards of excellence of that art form. Putting aside the fact that these judgments may send far too many young writers off on a different track from that which they might have followed, there is also the worry that these false judgments shape the very standard of excellence by which poems, novels, or paintings are appropriately judged. A thought that sweeps over us each time we read in the paper that a janitor has taken away a £40,000 piece of art, thinking it's rubbish, and we hear Larkin muttering, "I told you so," from his grave. So there were times, I have to say, when only the thought of this avuncular-looking man, this, to me, quite infallible walking bullshit detector, kept me from feeling quite alone on the planet or laying about me with a meat axe. I can recall a day, as a guest, courtesy the Arts Council of Scotland, at a seminar at Jordan Hill Teachers Training College in Glasgow, where there had been some misunderstanding about in which year the average Scottish pupil might, without being stretched too far, be introduced to the concept of inverted commas to signal direct speech. Year two is a bit early, claimed the lecturer. Yes, I agreed, all amiability. I'm pretty sure we didn't tackle all that stuff till we were at least 8 years old. The Teachers Training College lecturer stared at me. I meant the second year of secondary. I took a breath, not sure if he were joking. And then, when later in the seminar, someone else offered the quite unarguable, I should have thought, observation that teaching English at secondary level to an unstreamed class was harder than teaching a streamed class, the same man fell on her. Are you advocating educational apartheid? Now, when I scrambled to my feet to point out that if you accuse a student taking your course of advocating any sort of apartheid, you couldn't be making it clearer that you were out to close down discussion, he got quite testy. I must have sat there after the session ended, fuming and muttering, because later at the rail station, one of those students who'd been there said to me, "Actually, I thought you must have flipped." What, I said, just because I dared answer back that totalitarian-minded bastard who teaches you. No, she said, because you were sitting there afterwards with your head in your hands muttering, "Larkin, Larkin, calm down and think of Philip Larkin." So it may well be thanks to my hero that I did not end up losing my rag totally and spending the next 12 years in Barlinnie. Where, if the cells had been unshared and soundproofed well enough, I think that either he or I might have been perfectly happy. After all, as Martin Amis has pointed out, the writer is never so much himself as when he is alone. We don't go around craving excitement. Larkin lived in a boring house on a boring street in, forgive me, I beg you, something that is thought of as a somewhat boring town, and did what many think of as a boring job. It was Thomas Mann who admitted that a great writer needs to have a strong element of the bourgeois in his makeup. In this respect, Larkin probably went further than necessary. In one of his poems, there is the claim that phrases like, "he chucked up everything and just cleared off," offer most people a thrill. But we know that, like Vilgjemur Stefansson, Larkin the person would more easily have said, "I hate the very word adventure. It means that something has gone wrong." But unlike Stefansson, who to his credit was an Arctic explorer, we all know that Larkin would be saying it from the comfort of his armchair, wearing probably a grey-ribbed cardi and with a drink in his hand. The next thing I admire about Philip Larkin, the man I never met, is that he didn't go skittering around the world selling himself. I so admire him for that. We authors talk about ourselves too much. We become, in Kay Redfield Jamison's phrase, bleached of meaning and feeling. She feared that in putting herself in the position of speaking too freely and too often, her experiences would become remote and inaccessible and far distant. And that wasn't Larkin's worry, of course. He just thought writers made asses of themselves, shunting round bragging. He says in Required Writing, "I remember saying once, I can't understand these chaps who go around American universities explaining how they write poems. It's like going around explaining how you sleep with your wife." And he insisted that, "once I have said that the poems written in or near Hull, Yorkshire, with a succession of Royal Sovereign 2B pencils during the years 1955 to 1963, there seems little to add." Christ, how I wish a man like him ran every single one of the firms that publishes every single one of us. We couldn't be more cynical about the business ourselves. Here's Updike. "I can only decry the drain on the brain." Ian McEwan describes going on tour with a novel that's finally been published as like being the employee of a former self. Martin Amis says, "The enemies of promise used to be Hollywood, fancy journalism, alcohol and so on, these days the main enemy is being interviewed. Margaret Atwood said that wanting to meet the author because you like their books is a little like wanting to meet the duck because you like pate. Updike again. Writers can get over-interviewed. The whole performance indicates that you're quite a swell fellow just by being you, whereas we know that what merit we have, if any, resides elsewhere. It rots a writer's brain, it cretinises you. Inaccessibility is the best way of saying no. So we all know it, but it was Philip Larkin who did the best job of staying away from things. Nor did he kid himself that those he denied were missing much. When he described the composition of each of his poems as simply trying to get closer to setting down exactly some tune he'd forgotten, we see we're in the country of those who don't particularly associate the self who puts on his socks or visits his mother with the self who is writing. I pat myself on the back because, like Larkin, I believe that art is a product, not a process. Whatever works. And I refuse to teach creative writing classes to adults or children. The very word workshop sets me as part of the ugly rush towards the exit. But here I am today, aren't I? And it's probably by no means the last time out of the house. No doubt I will be flattered, bribed or persuaded into strutting my stuff one way or another on occasions until I'm too doddery to travel. But if I look at the files of stuff I've written that isn't my own proper work, I could sit down and weep. I know what's valuable, and I couldn't stick to it. Thanks principally to the Americans' early example, bolstered by the spread of the telly chat show and Arts Council grants, the ghastly business of involving almost all authors in the selling of their work is not just here in earnest, but has dug itself in. Of course, at times when an author's on a roll, he or she can change tack, pretend their earlier amenability was simply some aberration till they learned the knack of saying no, and then make a lofty virtue of packing it in. But the great bulk of us know that the way things are organised now, the number of readers we have, let alone sales, is linked at least in part to our own energy about promotion. We let the exigencies of modern publishing drain our crystals. But some of us hold someone like Larkin in all the higher esteem because we haven't had the strength of mind to do what he did and tell the whole boiling of them to bugger off. I'm not a critic. As I said at the start, all I can speak about is the effect this poet had on me. It is his frank and honest portrayal of real emotions that I take as a benchmark. One of the things I find so hard to take about the work of so many of my colleagues who write, as I do, half the time for children, is their oh-so-easy, idle trotting out of stale, false and clichéd assumptions about young people's emotions. To offer just one example, clearly some influential therapist once said that children blame themselves for the divorce. Now, we don't have to think for long to see why this nonsense caught on so fast. Wouldn't it be nice if it were true? But be honest, you may know plenty of divorces, but do you actually know any of these poor, benighted lambs who blame themselves? I don't. And yet we suffer book after book about damaged and broken families that takes this assumption for granted, when one look round would make it clear as paint that second marriages apart, when many a child has set out as a wrecker, and some might feel a bit of guilt after, this response is actually a rarity. Most sentient children know only too well where the blame lies when their life falls apart or turns into a matter of tiresomely fortnightly train rides. They may have more tact and sense than to push things even further by rather pointlessly saying so, but no one should kid themselves that they don't know. You'd never get that sort of rubbish from Larkin. He was dead honest. You read him on feelings and you think either, yes, that's how it would have been, or closer to home, yes, that's how it is. Read work of this quality and your sense of the complexity of life steadily increases, always a virtue. And though the truth he writes of may not be a truth for us or for the people we know best, we recognise that it's a truth out there for someone, and we are the wiser. Because as we all know from bitter personal experience, being around people who are impoverished in their understanding of how they themselves and other people tick is, as Norman McCaig put it, as frustrating as being an engineer around people who can't understand the most basic scientific principles of the lever, say, or the pump. Asking himself what use is poetry, McCaig reminded us, the arts induce us to respond to and examine the emotional significance as well as the rational significance of whatever comes under our notice. And to have unexamined emotional responses is as much a sign of immaturity as to have unexamined beliefs. Those of you who have read my novels will know that the one thing they all have in common, from the book From the Youngest Children right up to the grimmest of the adult black comedies, is a determination to try to describe relationships not as we would like to see them, but as they are, and still find value in them. Here, I'd be proud to think I even edged close to the shadow of Larkin. There's nothing stale or second-hand about his work. Right through the pretty, well, unquantifiably wide range of subjects he chose to write about, we see not just the examined emotional response, but crystal honesty shot through with, for all his clear eye, a true love and a true respect for people. Through his poems, he shows his own face. In a fable, Borges has a man who sets himself the task of sketching a world. Through the years, he populates a space with images of provinces, kingdoms, mountains, bays, ships, islands, fishes, rooms, instruments, stars, horses and persons. Shortly before dying, he discovers that this patient labyrinth of lines traces the image of his own face. So dispiriting, then, that for a short time, while we heard the words Philip Larkin and the words image in the same sentence, we found ourselves facing those who would try to claim that a biography, even a fine biography, could somehow illuminate the inner as well as the outer man better than does the work. While I was struggling to write clearly all I was thinking about this, I happened to read the critic D.J. Enright's last commonplace book, Interplay, where he himself used the response to Larkin as an example for a particular gripe. And I hope that the shade of Mr. Enright won't mind that I've edited a little to focus on the bits about Larkin that don't just mirror what I think, but put it far better than I could. He says, "We learn, say, that Philip Larkin was most unadmirable in person. And since we unthinkingly embrace what C.S. Lewis called the personal heresy, whereby the life and the works are simply two diverse expressions of this single quiddity, we can no longer admire and enjoy his poems, but for which no one would have written a biography of him or edited his letters. Because, despite what we may say to the contrary, we don't really believe that a bastard like that could write perfectly shaped, plangent lyrics. We should ask ourselves whether someone who wrote such poems could ever be such a bastard. Mm-hmm. Why don't we? Because we trust the biography or the letters more than the work, although the work comes from deep down in the man, while the best biography in the world only scratches the surface. Can you, dear reader, envisage with equanimity a biography of yourself? Aren't you pretty sure it would be a travesty of the self, which is more complex, more mixed than anyone could ever know? Serious people tell you, I'm still quoting Enright, serious people tell you, we read about the life in order to understand the work better. Why not read the work in order to understand the life better? D.J. Enright wisely goes on to remind us, the work is the best side of a writer's life. And into my mind springs an expression of Sylvia Townsend Warner's in her biography of T.H. White, when she spoke of how, by grace of technique, wrongs will repent to diamonds. So you can see why, in the summer of 1985, when I was skittering around the kitchen in my flat in Edinburgh, I was so saddened by the news that Philip Larkin had been taken into hospital in Hull. The news must have saddened huge numbers all over the country, because I seem to remember later bulletins actually mentioning how many messages of goodwill were flooding into the hospital. This did not surprise me. The whole of the day the news came, I'd been disquieted, and then in the evening found myself doing something I'd never done before, sitting down to write a fan letter. I wrote to Larkin to thank him for his poems. I wrote to tell him that he must surely know his work could be remembered as long as poetry is read, and I have no doubt I offered my best wishes. And all this years before I came to think of it as normal for readers to send letters to writers. Up until then, it had never happened to me, and I don't come from a letter-writing family. I think it was an act of human sympathy as much as anything else. Here was a man we all knew from his work, dreaded both death and being dead. We all know death is harder to accept if part of you feels you haven't fully lived. And he had said as much, not least when he said, "What mainly worries me is a strengthening suspicion that there is in my character an antipathy between art and life." When he gave in, as he put it, to another person, he said, "There is a slackening and dulling of the peculiar artistic fibres that make it impossible to achieve that mental clenching that crystallises a pattern and keeps it still while you draw it." It's not for me to say, but I myself can't wish that Philip Larkin had led any other life. If he had done so, we would not have the poems as they were written, shining the light of his art on half-hidden truths and bringing to all his readers first that shock of recognition and then enrichment, his gift always, a way of seeing one more thing about what he referred to as the million-petaled flower of being here in deeper depth, with deeper understanding. The trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. For all his readers, for as long as can be imagined, that would have been the very worst of losses. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Anne Fine, who kindly gave us permission to reproduce her wonderful talk, and to Georgia Glover from the David Higham Agency. Anne was reportedly very happy for us to use this, adding anything for PL and his poetry. And if you'd like to listen to this year's Distinguished Guest Lecture at the PLS AGM, then please keep an eye on our website and make sure you are signed up to our newsletter at philiplarkin.com. If you want to be certain of an invitation, then please think about becoming a member, if you aren't already. You can join via the website and get access to in-person and online members' events, as well as our wonderful journal about Larkin. And that helps support the podcast too. This podcast was produced by me, Lynn Lockwood, and Gavin Hogg, and the music was The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future topics, then please, as ever, do get in touch.
Of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of dew. The dawn reassembles.